Good evening again, friends. And after a full day, I sometimes think that the head can take in only as much as the end can endure. So we'll see how we make out this evening. I posed the question last evening, or began to pose it, and I will pose it again tonight with much more purpose in mind than I had last evening even. And that is, if you were asked to name, to say, just what it is you are seeking, not money, not fame, not any of the transient, evanescent things which pass all too easily. But what are you deeply, deeply seeking? Would you be able to name it? Would you say peace, wholeness, understanding, wisdom, compassion? What would it be? Or would it be too deep for words? Something that you can't really quite express, that you know that there is something more. Or perhaps it's just the search for meaning. Why do events happen as they do? And perhaps it's just that haunting question, why? Without any of the other aspects of the why. Why is the grass green, or why is the sky blue? Why do trees grow up and not down? Why does the lake stay on the planet and not fly off? Or just simply, why? A kind of question that I think from one point of view haunts us all our lives, stays with us from earliest childhood. Why? Because at some time or other, if we're really honest with ourselves, if we really examine our lives, all of us have asked that question. We've begun a search. Perhaps that's what has brought us to the Theosophical Society, to various lectures, to books, but all always in search of that answer, to why. Which means we've started on a quest. In fact, to have a question is to be a quester, and therefore to be on a quest. You can't have a question without beginning a search for an answer. And at the same time, you know, we're really uncomfortable with questions. Very interesting, this afternoon, Murray asked a number of questions. And I suppose not only the panel was trying to answer them or seeking answers, but everyone who was really listening was also seeking an answer. Some of the questions could not be answered. Oh yes, you answered them, of course, the panel, that was their business to answer them. But did they answer them? Or did the question continue to ring, to sort of, and I put it, resound within you, to go on and on and on? Even those on the panel. To live with questions is not an easy existence, because we're uncomfortable with questions, and yet, are we always satisfied with the answers that are given? Well, we're really here together this evening because we are all on a quest. You have a question whether you know it or not, whether you can express it or not. So let us imagine that we are on a journey together, which we are, a journey of life, which we often see in sort of linear terms, that my life has been going along with its ups and downs and its interesting sort of bypaths and so on. And here we are, we've come together tonight on this journey. And for a little time, we've stopped here in this room, which is a kind of oasis, if you like, in the progress of our journey, a resting place. When I was, some years ago, driving with a friend in England and Scotland, we would come to little areas just off the road that were called laybys. I don't know what they call them here in New Zealand. Sometimes in the United States we call them rest areas and so on, but I like the term layby. And so let us pretend that this evening we have come to a layby, which means you lay by all your anxieties, your questions, your hopes, your fears, your dreams, you relax for a little while. We've come to a layby. And let us think of this time together tonight then as a little time spent in one of these laybys, if you like, where we can let go of our normal concerns. This is what happens when you come away from your normal occupations anyway. And most of us are, I presume, away from our normal occupations. I say most of us because I suppose one of my normal occupations is lecturing, you know. So I'm not very far away from it. Not really lecturing, just chatting. Because we've come to this lay-by and we're going to chat together for a little time. But we lay aside our usual concerns, our anxieties, and any problems that we may have faced at home, and examine something together of the nature of the journey. Of course, each of us will eventually resume the journey on which we are embarked. At least by Saturday morning, I presume, we will resume the journey, going our separate ways, going to wherever is our home, and therefore getting out of this lay-by that is the Tahara Center. It's nice to be called a retreat center because it's the lay-by we're in. Now, this doesn't mean that in the days that we're here together, or even this evening, we will have found all of the answers to the questions that we may be asking. Doesn't mean we'll have discovered the end of our quest. Perhaps we will have discovered that we've scarcely begun the quest. And I hope, perhaps this evening, you will leave here with more questions than you had when you came. Because to live with questions means you're a quester. You're on a quest. You're not satisfied as yet. Now, a lay-by on the road not only provides a time for rest or a little time out to chat a bit and to refresh ourselves, it's also occasion, if one is driving or walking on the road, when one can consult a map. I presume all of us who have driven cars at some time or other drive off to one side of the road and look at the map. Have you ever done that? Is there anybody who drives a car who hasn't at some time or other said, I better look at the map, see where I'm going, you know? It helps us to know the direction. It helps us to really identify if we're moving in the direction in which we intended to move. And we notice where the next turnings may come and how the road ahead it may possibly look. The map, of course, is not the road. Anyone who's looked at a map, I'm sure you'll all agree with me, the map is not the road. The road looks beautiful on the map. Then you may drive it. You find there are potholes. You find there are detours. I often say the greatest French road builder in the world, Detour. Found in every country. But the road on the map may look perfectly straight. When you drive it, what happens? There are a lot of twists and bends and turns. It goes over hills and perhaps up mountains and down other mountainsides and so on. So the map is not the road, but it's useful to consult it. So I'd like to suggest that in coming together in this lay-by, we can use the time profitably to consult the map of our being and determine our direction. In fact, may I suggest we might even have a little picnic together. Now I know that tea is coming afterwards, but you can use your imaginations. So I'm going to change the scene just a little, if I may. And since we've been using this metaphor of a journey, and we've reached the lay-by along the road, we can just as easily adapt the metaphor to provide for any imaginary scene that we wish. Isn't that the wonderful thing about imagination? You know. Now that I have you all visualizing us together in this lay-by, let's try to see if we can conjure up another scene. I'm going to suggest that you reach this lay-by by hitchhiking here. You picked up rides as they happened to be available. Whenever a car stopped, you got in, rode a while, got out, walked a while, until another car came along. Perhaps that's the way we saunter through life. At least many people do. You know, we find this book that fascinates us, and so we read that for a while. That's what I mean by getting in a car and riding for a while. Then we get out and we walk, which means we think about it a little bit, perhaps. And then another car comes along. It promises us so much. It's a beautiful car, Mercedes, or Rolls Royce, or something, if you think. That sounds very promising. The driver knows, looks as though he knows what he's about. So we'll ride with that car for a bit. So we join that organization, go along with that driver for a while, and then we get out. So in one way or another, you've reached this lay-by where we are here together. And what do you discover? Three cars are here ahead of us in the lay-by. And the drivers of these cars are also enjoying their picnic lunches. And what happens? Quite naturally, a conversation begins. And as you get into your conversation, you find that the other three are also consulting their maps. Now, remember that at the outset I asked you if you could name what you most wanted, what you were really searching for. Well, of course, that was your destination. Peace, wholeness, love, compassion, perhaps something you really don't know, but there's some mysterious name on the map, and that you've decided is your destination. And you discover that by some mysterious process, because imagination is very active, by some mysterious process, the three drivers of the cars that you discover here in the lay-by are also going to the same place that you have named. Because whatever place you named is the same destination that all other drivers and they're in the lay-by are going to. And each of these drivers has offered you a ride. How are you going to choose which one to go with? Well, who are these drivers? It's always handy to know their names, isn't it? If you're going to ride a ways with somebody, it's helpful to know the name. So the first one says to you, my name is Mystic. And the second one says to you, My name is Yogi. And the third one says to you, my name, yes, is Theosophia. Well, you know their names, but now what about their credentials, their driving records, so to speak? It's useful, you know, if you're going to get into a car, to really know something about them. Well, I suppose you're bored with this metaphor, so let's let it go for a little while. We may come back to it. If we, of course, just stay there and lay by listening to their credentials, which is to say their driving record, we'll never get out on the road again. And since this is all a matter of imagination, or really a matter of consciousness, because I would call your attention to the fact that what we are dealing with is consciousness, whether in its guise as imagination or memory, remembering, whatever, we are dealing with consciousness. When we ask about, for example, the Mahatma, the adept, the wise one, it's a matter of consciousness. It's all a matter of consciousness. Well, we can even travel with them, therefore, simultaneously. Now, isn't that amazing? Well, we'll see. But because we need to describe the journey and we need to use some words, because you're here to presumably find out how this is going to end, it will appear that we are traveling with each one in rotation. But keep in mind that even what appears to be so is not so. So I'm talking about them in rotation, but we are traveling with them all simultaneously. So let's define the terms that I've used in the title of these remarks. First of all, you'll notice that these are the names that were given to the three drivers who've offered rides to us. So just to make the definitions as precise, rather as concise, as brief as possible, let me put it this way. Remember, we're all having our lunch together. You can't be very hungry, you've just had dinner, so here now. So if I talk about a picnic lunch, you won't mind too much. So to make the definitions just as brief, concise, and yet precise as possible, each one tells you this. Yes, I'm a mystic, because I am one who knows the taste of the ineffable. The second one says, yes, I told you I am yogi, because a yogi is one who knows the taste of the ineffable. And the third one says, yes, of course, I told you I am Theosophia. Because a theosophist, not a member of the Theosophical Society, a theosophist, a true theosophist, is one who knows the taste of the ineffable. Now, of course, you say, well, given the same definition for all three terms. Yes, because as I told you, if we return to the metaphor, all three drivers are going on the same road to the same destination, however you named that destination. And that's why we can travel with them simultaneously, because ultimately they are the same. Mystic, yogi, theosophist. We really did see three drivers, or we thought we saw three drivers. And they gave us three different names. But now that we've asked them a little more about themselves, they've all told us precisely the same thing. They all have the same credentials, as it were. So, We need to look at this a little bit. Remember, we were having a picnic lunch, and each one of us had an apple. It's good to have an apple on a picnic lunch, isn't it? It's handy to eat and so on. And so you turn to each one and you say, does your apple taste good? Does your apple taste good? And what does each one answer? It tastes very good. But how do I describe it? It's ineffable, which means I just can't put it into words. Isn't this a common experience? Have you ever tried to describe the taste of an apple to someone? What do you say if you're asked if the apple tastes good? Yes, of course, I'm eating it, I'm enjoying it, the apple tastes good. Would you like a bite? You see, and then you take a bite and you say, ooh, it's tart, ooh, it's too hard on my teeth, it's cold, so it doesn't taste so good to you. So what is the taste of an apple? It's a very simple question. Can anyone tell me, really, what is the taste of an apple? Or, better yet, what is the taste of a good apple? Think about it. Well, I suppose at this point you're ready to go back to wherever you're going, and go to bed and forget about all this. So let's see if I can get you out of the dilemma into which we seem to have wandered. Perhaps we need to set aside completely this metaphor, which I've been using, to which I keep returning, and suggest that these three characters, for they are characters, the mystic, the yogi, the theosophist, represent three modes of travel on this journey on which we are all embarked. The mystic is actually more familiar to us than we may even suspect, because there is something of the mystic in all of us. If you really examine it, essentially, the core of mysticism, the central fact, if I can put it this way, the central fact of the mystic experience is the involvement of a different kind of consciousness than your ordinary, everyday consciousness. Than the normal, everyday consciousness functions. We may say, then, that the mystic is the one who has experienced that different order of consciousness in such a way as to give him or her an experience that can never be put into words, fully into words. In other words, the mystic is one who has entered a domain of consciousness in which everything, the world, people, chairs, tables, glasses, flowers, everything suddenly has an inner clarity, a luminosity about it. It shines as though from within. Now you may say it's an ordinary chair. How can a chair shine from within? But the experience of seeing a chair fully, wholly as a chair means it has an inner luminosity, a clarity that cannot be denied. It's a domain of consciousness in which there is a realization of the wholeness of things. And the mystic has entered that domain through an experience which is ultimately indefinable. We have all had that experience. Tell me what is blueness. Tell me what is hotness. Tell me what is hardness. Tell me what is a flower. What is a flower? Not this flower or that flower, but what is a flower? Can it be ultimately defined? Once you have entered into that experience, once that experience has opened before you, you realize you are in a domain of knowing that nothing, nothing can fully explain. If, for example, we read any of the writings of some of the great mystics, we recognize that their lives were touched in some mysterious way by an experience that seemed to transcend the ordinary, and yet which by its very nature illumined the ordinary and for a moment made it extraordinary. All boundaries became non-existent. The ordinary, for even a moment, became the extraordinary. We can express this in another way. Ordinary consciousness, the consciousness in which we are normally operating, perceives boundaries. Boundaries between this and that. Boundaries between you and the chair. It's very convenient. We don't confuse categories, as psychologists would put it. We don't get confused on, you know, whether it's you or the chair. If you do, I'm not sure you belong here. But I'll leave that to the national president of your section to take care of. We perceive boundaries between all that is I and all that is not I. So we don't become confused. Now, in the true mystic experience, and I'm not talking about the psychic experience of fantasy, of which enlarges boundaries, but in the true mystic experience, all boundaries dissolve. Such boundaries are simply non-existent. There is neither I nor not I. There is only the experience, the one without a second. Technical terms in mysticism, this is the unio mystica, the moment in which there are no boundaries. We've all experienced it, I'm sure, in a moment of supreme love, of genuine love. Where are the boundaries? In that moment of sheer beauty, looking at a sunrise or a sunset, listening to a Beethoven symphony, better yet, one of the last quartets of Beethoven, listening to some great piece of music that carries us beyond ourselves, if we are really in it, when you look at a sunset, you're really present, totally, wholly present, there is no boundary. It is not I am looking at the sunset. And certainly not the sunset is looking at me. We've all had moments of that. Moments of tender compassion. Moments of great love. Moments of great sorrow. When, as the Buddha put it in Sir Edwin Arnold, speaking of the Buddha, we wept with all humanity's sorrow. When there was that moment in which no boundaries existed, that experience, which while it requires the vehicle of language to unfold, never exhausts itself in finished language. It's an experience that somehow lends luminosity to all one's life. I have yet to meet anyone in all my travels all over the world who has not at some moment or other experienced that interior oneness, that luminosity. So think of your lives. Such an experience can come at most unexpected times and in the midst of most prosaic duties, making a bed, washing a cup, picking a rose, touching a beloved face. Such simple activities as tying one's shoes, putting a postage stamp on a letter, and sending it with love to some distant place. The theosophist Dr. Robert Elwood, in his book Mysticism and Religion, has defined the experience, insofar as it can be defined, by saying that mystical experience is experience which is immediately or subsequently interpreted by the experiencer as encounter with ultimate reality in a direct, non-rational way which engenders a deep sense of unity and of living during the experience on a level of being other than the ordinary. We may come crashing down from the experience, you know. You may be watching the sunset and lost in the marvel of the color and the majesty of it, the beauty, the overwhelming power of it. And suddenly the telephone rings in the house and you dash in. Or suddenly the dog barks, or the kitten brushes against your leg, or someone halloos to you, wake up, come on, let's get back to the ordinary life. But for the moment, you have lived on a level of being other than the ordinary. The Jungian psychologist, Dr. Erich Neumann, who has charted the history and growth of consciousness, has proposed indeed that by our very nature, the nature of being human, the essence of our humanity, we are homo mysticus. This is indeed nothing other than what is said in the theosophical literature. Nothing other than is said in the ancient Vedic terms, in the Upanishadic terms. Not only are we beings with mind, homo sapiens, not very wise much of the time, but so homo rationalis, rational, or we think we are very rational beings. You know, we always pride ourselves on our rationality, but most of the time we act very irrational. Let's admit it, you know. But we pride ourselves on being very rational. You ever said to someone, you say, can't you see the reason for this? Because we see it all too clearly. We think everyone else should see it. Because we're acting so irrationally over our rationality. But at our basis, suggests Dr. Neumann at least, we are, in terms of the very ground of our being, one with that impartible reality which is both transcendent to and immanent within all existent things. As the Upanishads have so wonderfully expressed this ancient truth, Atman is Brahman. Atman is Brahman. Tat Tvam Asi. That ultimate, that reality beyond all transient realities, that ultimate reality, that thou art. Tat Tvam Asi. At the very heart of our being. This is the theosophical message. The very heart of our being is that one ultimate reality. The true development of consciousness, then, according to Dr. Neumann, occurs through archetypal encounters which give a mystical stamp to the inner development of every individual. In the lives of each of us, we begin to recognize those moments when we seemed, even for the briefest space of time, to enter a timeless and a spaceless dimension. These awakenings, as we might call them, can never be forgotten. And we have all had them. The moment we came awake to the magnificent, coherent, and totally all-embracing metaphysics of the theosophical worldview, that was an awakening indeed. That awakening, when we came to realize what love is in the face of the beloved. For as Plato points out in the Symposium, we move from the recognition of love in the beautiful that we see before us to the recognition of the beautiful in all things. And finally, the beautiful as ground of the universe. And so these awakenings occur. They can never be forgotten. And in subtle and often not so subtle ways, they transform us. They mark us. They mark also what one writer has called the kairos of a new life. That is to say, that magical moment, that moment of fate, term used by St. Paul in the New Testament, kairos. The moment that one turns about, as it were, in the seat of consciousness, as the Buddhist would put it. That moment when it's the most fateful moment, and I refer to it in that awakening when we come to the theosophical worldview, because we're never the same again. You cannot unlearn it. You cannot unremember it. Not just forget it. You cannot unremember it. You cannot unlearn it. This is why I often say theosophy is like a virus. Gets into your blood, never lets you go, it shakes you. It recurs again and again, you know, if you really are in earnest about it. And so the mystical moment, that magical moment of the experience which has transformed you, means that all things are changed and all things become new for us. Our eyes are opened, and we see as though for the first time. This is indeed what the mystic experience is all about. This is what the mystic is saying. In a beautiful little book called The Lost Dimension by the writer Hugh Lanson-Fossé, he has written of that entry into the mystical domain of consciousness in this way. To be centered in the boundless depth and height of being, we might even say of beingness, to follow H.P. Blavatsky's term, to be centered in the boundless depth and height of being is a mystery which can only be experienced by us within the bounds of time and space, but which transcends the world it illuminates and life, the form it animates. The bounds of existence still contain us, but no longer bind us. The bounds of self no longer imprison or alienate. Yet the nearer we come to being, he writes, the greater is our sense of identity, both in ourselves and with every other person and thing that we now see in the light of being. In those moments, there are no alien objects for us to see. All are part of the one being in which we share. And this one being is itself not some vast, impalpable object to be grasped and possessed. Of course not, because it is ourselves, our very nature, our very being. And as those moments of awakening continue and grow longer, we realize, as I put it last night, we begin to remember that future when we will be indeed fully, wholly awake, which is to be Buddha. For the Buddha was only the one who came to a complete state of wakefulness, never to fall asleep again. Most of us, you know, walk around as sort of sleepwalkers, but we have these moments of awakening, these moments of wakefulness, and then we fall asleep, content with the separate self, content to move about and see chairs as chairs and tables as tables and people as people. But the Buddha, and this we must remember, this is the remembrance of that which we are, to be wholly, totally awake. For the mystic vision is thus the transformative vision. Not only do we see in a new way, but since we ourselves are new, the mystical consciousness can be understood only as an active, transformative process, accomplishing changes in all aspects of the structure of our existence, human, world, and relationship. Entry into the domain of the sacred, for the experience is really indeed of the sacred, and all things are sacralized, if I can put it that way. Everything becomes sacred. The experience finds the fullness of its meaning in the conscious return to the world where we inevitably act in a new way. For the mystic is indeed one who acts now in a new way, for he sees all things differently. Again, to quote Fosse, to be human is to bring the kingdom of light down to earth and to raise up earth to heaven. That, I would suggest, is our unique vocation. That is our calling. For to have a vocation is to be called. To be called from the future, as I put it last evening. To be called from beyond. To be called from the heights, if you like. And our singular calling is indeed to bring that vision to earth. And in fulfilling this responsibility, we become truly and wholly human. One of the great Christian mystics, Richard of St. Victor, proposed in a book of the same title that there are 4 degrees of passionate charity. It's a marvelous title. Because the mystic is one whose experience is that of a passionate caring for the world. He is passionate about everything except himself and his own sort of stewing. Put it that way. The 4 degrees of passionate charity. He put it this way. In the first degree, God enters into the soul, and she turns inward into herself. In the second, she ascends above herself and is lifted up to God. In the third, the soul, lifted up to God, passes over altogether into Him. Now, we may say that is the climax of the mystical experience, to be Passover altogether into that marvelous union with the divine, with the ultimate. But he points out, in the fourth, the soul goes forth on God's behalf and descends below herself. And so there are these 4 degrees, or as William Blake put it, I rest not from my task to open the eternal worlds, to open the immortal eyes of man inwards into the worlds of thought, into eternity ever expanding in the bosom of God. Or as the Dominican monk and disciple of Meister Eckhart, Johannes Tauler, said it very simply, and if in your work you experience an inward touching. A beautiful phrase. As though you are tapped on the shoulder. You experience an inward touching. Then give proper heed to it in your work. And thus you may learn to carry God into your work. Everything becomes sanctified. Everything then is sacred. One moves from a new point of view. We could go on quoting. Yet nowhere, I think, has this human vocation, the call that arises unbidden in the heart of the one who has truly known the mystic experience, been more beautifully expressed than in the poetic words of that little gem given us by H.P. Blavatsky at the very end of her life, translated from an ancient text, The Voice of the Silence, interestingly enough, dedicated to the few real mystics in the Theosophical Society. Know that the stream of superhuman knowledge and the Deva wisdom thou hast won must from thyself be poured forth into another bed. Know, thou of the secret path, its pure fresh waters must be used to sweeter make the ocean's bitter waves, that mighty sea of sorrow formed of the tears of men. Now bend thy head and listen well. Compassion speaks and saith, can there be bliss when all that lives must suffer? Shalt thou be saved and hear the whole world cry? So it has been said that the experience of the mystic must authenticate itself not only in one's own life, but in the service one may do for others by one's very presence in the world. As Aldous Huxley once suggested, the mystics, which is every one of us, should be the sleepless ones who keep the world disinfected. We no longer pollute the emotional and mental realms of our nature, let alone the sensuous realm, by thoughts of self, self-aggrandizement, self-concern, of worry, of anxiety, of fear. These are the great polluters of consciousness. So we disinfect the world. Now at the same time, the quest for and the experience of inwardness, as we may term the path of the mystic, involves a tremendous amount of exertion. Is a life-consuming involvement in which one undertakes a careful cultivation of the psychological and spiritual nature. We may refer again to Johannes Tauler, that 14th century Dominican monk, as an example of one for whom the mystic way was not merely momentary experiences, a matter of momentary experiences, but involved a self-conscious ordering of one's life. A crafting, as he called it, which I love, a crafting of one's life. Because it is the art of living. One crafts one's life accordingly. So that one's whole life, all one's behavior, all one's thought, feeling, emotion, are radicalized as the means or vehicles for the intensification and the focusing of the relation between the inner and outer realms of existence. Tauler, for example, was not only a Dominican monk, but he was a great Neoplatonist. And for him, the essential task of returning to the eternal ground of being became an everyday psychological and spiritual undertaking. In other words, the mystic must also be the yogi. For the experience of the numinous, which is the mystical experience, is not only a transformative one, it is a continuing process in which its meaningfulness reveals itself in the careful attention given to and the constant cultivation of one's psychological and spiritual life. Yoga, in other words, is nothing less than the cleansing of the doors of perception, as William Blake put it, a process which demands a wakeful state, but is not full of the little self-concern, but is a clearing of the field. Because one may ask, to what does one attend? One of the sayings attributed to the great Buddhist teacher of the second century, Nagarjuna, answers it very simply in question four. What else is there, said Nagarjuna, what else is there but to keep watch over one's mind both day and night? That is yoga. What else is there but to keep watch over one's mind both day and night? For to keep watch over the activities of the mind, its modifications, its chattering, monkey-driven, you know, activities, its emotionally driven play, requires a clearing of the field of thought, a removal of all obstructions, impediments, distractions which litter the field of consciousness. Yoga may be considered as that spiritual praxis, that psychological discipline or process required for clearing the inner field of our being in order that we may awaken to the true light of reality, in order that consciousness may reflect that pure light of reality, the pure light of discriminative wisdom, which has often been called buddhi, which means it is awake. The light is clear. And so the field of consciousness reflects that clarity. The eye that perceives is single, and the heart that knows throbs in unison with the one. To attend to that process, to that praxis, is, as all yogic texts indicate, the supremely human task. Now, what holds us back from giving such constant attention? The restlessness of the mind, whipped about by the winds of desire, agitated by the eddy-forming currents of egoism in the stream of existence. That obscures the true knowledge of the one self. So there arises in our psychological nature all the impediments that divert us from our true or essential self, veil us, because we throw up the mist of egoism, the mist of self-concern, the mist of fog through which we can no longer see at one self seated in the heart of all beings. Basic, of course, to those impediments is ignorance. In the yogic texts, avidya, non-seeing, which is also non-knowing, because vid is both seeing and knowing. To see is to know. To really see, to fully see clearly, is to know. A lack of awareness the one reality in which we are rooted. And ignorance gives then a rise to false identification of ourselves, with those very desires which obscure vision. From those desires and the constant play of attraction and repulsion, which feeds our sense of personal being, our I am I-ness, our self-esteem and self-importance, arise all the mental constructs that perpetuate our sense of separateness, our sense of egoism, our ignorance, and the false identification of ourselves with our possessions, or our capacities, or our cultures, or our titles, our religions, our nationalities, and all the other multiplicity of things, ideas, hopes, fears, and dreams which seem to be so necessary to maintain the separate, independent self. Dr. Jayadeva Singh was a perfectly wonderful person. He was a member of the Theosophical Society in India, and I heard him on a number of occasions when I was in India in earlier years. Has written a wonderful commentary on one of the Kashmiri Shaivites, sutras, the Shiva Sutra, called the Yoga of Supreme Identity. And in that, he has pointed out that in the empirical individual, which is you and me, each one of us, reality, or the divine transcendental self, is light, bliss that is ever shining within in its glory, but is hidden from our gaze on account of our thought constructs. It is there, it is shining. This morning it was raining and we saw the dark clouds scuttling across the sky. Was the sun absent? Or was it our vision that could not pierce those clouds? When the clouds dissipated, where did they go? The clouds simply dissipated, didn't they? The sun shone once again. It's as simple as that. But we hide ourselves. We remove ourselves. We throw up all the sand in our eyes of personal concerns, personal egoism. As he put it further, reality is an eternal presence within ourselves. We are prisoners of our own mind. There is an inner dimension of reality in which we are always living, but which we do not know. Yoga exhorts us to rediscover and realize it. So the entire process of dealing with these psychological obstructions is one of understanding the nature of the self, the nature of that objective reality which we call the universe about us, and the nature of that ultimate reality which is both transcendent to and immanent within all existent beings. This triune understanding, the understanding of who we are, really, the understanding of the universe, and the understanding of the reality of that tat, that ultimate reality, which permits both self and universe to exist, is grounded in and comprises a wisdom which by its very nature not only constitutes the highest metaphysics, but is also testable and verifiable in our own experiences by those willing to live the life necessary to gain such confirmation of its postulates. The testability of that essential wisdom, the Theosophia of the ages, is evidenced in the lives and experiences of those genuine mystics and yogis, perhaps better called mystic yogis or yogic mystics, whom history has named as the saints and saviors, the Christs, the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, the fully realized ones of all ages, the wholly awakened ones. In writing of that primordial wisdom, that forgotten truth, as Dr. Houston Smith has called it, that secret doctrine of the ages, H.P. Blavatsky referred to it as the uninterrupted record covering thousands of generations of seers whose respective experiences were made to test and to verify the traditions. It was conveyed orally in the infancy of humanity, passed on later in glyph and symbol, buried in myth and allegory, and still to be found in the esoteric teachings of every great religion.